peaceable kingdom. And the entire painting, the idea behind the painting, was based off of Isaiah chapter 11, where Isaiah writes about the lion laying down with the lamb. And the painting doesn't reproduce very well. I don't know how well you can tell when you stretch it out to 8 feet wide and 6 feet tall. It disorients it just a little bit, but it is an awesome vision that Hicks has of a place of peace. If you are able to see it very well, you notice that there is a lion sitting beside of a cow. And beside of that, there is a tiger with a little baby and his arm thrown around the neck of the tiger. It is a collection, when you get it where you can see it very well, it is a collection of wild and domestic animals, both lying together in peace and harmony, sharing the same pasture, grazing together, living together in harmony. And Hicks' vision, like that of Isaiah, is a world of peace and love and tranquility. I wish, again, that it reproduced a little better at that size. When you see the painting, you just look at it, and I'm not much of an artist at all. If any of you ever even see me try to sign my own name, you know that our artistic ability all ended in David. It certainly didn't come from me. But when you look at this painting, I'm not sure how he was able, with paint and canvas, to just put one of those scenes together that you look at it and you're just kind of like, yeah, you know, it's just one of those things that when you look at, you can kind of drift off into. It's just a marvelous rendition of, again, of Isaiah's dream in chapter 11, and Hicks' vision and desire for, again, a land of peace and tranquility. And when we look at it and think about that, I think most, average, normal, I realize that there are some that seem to be intent on riot and harm and fighting and war, but I think most people look at that and say, man, that would be a wonderful world. We look at that and say, wouldn't that be an awesome place to be, where you know, the little child goes out in the yard and rides a tiger around the yard. You know, just what a wonderful world it would be to live in. But most of us are also very realistic and realize that peace seems to be elusive. It seems to be a moving target. Just when we think we've got it, it jumps. And so it is something that we talk about daily. You don't. I don't know that there's a day goes by that at some point during that day that someone on a newscast somewhere doesn't talk about peace in the Middle East, or peace here, or peace there, or peace that, peace treaty, peace talks, peace. It's just something that we are bombarded by, and I think quite honestly most of us have come to accept that talk as just so much gibberish, just so much, you know, they got to fill the half hour of news up with something, and so we don't have a lot of confidence in that idea of peace. And some of you grew up in a time when you were under the constant threat of Soviet Union attack. I have heard folks who are just a few years older than me discussing being in elementary school and having drills in case of military attack, and you know, getting under your desk. And I never have quite understood the logic of diving under your desk in view of a nuclear attack. You know, I guess that was the best thing they could think of. And so, but you know, many of you, like me, I think that was just a little bit before my time. Most of us don't know that, but we live in a time now where you can't get in your kid's school without buzzing and somebody coming out and frisking you, and, you know, and everything else. And, you know, I think of Tenzi's school, you know, one of the secretaries there, I graduated high school with. I've known her all my life. And yet if I go in there, it's like trying to, you know, gain access to Fort Knox or something. It's still, it's just a world where we live in, where peace is a thing we talk about, and yet it seems like it's just a moving target. It is just something that we talk about. I can think back as a child, and I don't know, it's funny the way things, what sticks in your head. And I can remember along about 78, 79, there was the big talk was the SALT II treaties. I don't know how many of you remember that. And I don't know why, I mean, I would have been in the eighth grade, why that sticks in my mind. But the SALT II treaty was the big thing. I don't know if you remember what SALT stood for, not high blood pressure, but SALT was the Strategic Arms Limitations Treaty. Why I remember that, I don't know. I promise you there's very little I remember about the eighth grade, but for some reason that stuck. And I don't even know that they taught that in school, just they're talking about. But the one thing I do remember thinking about is I kept hearing them talk about the SALT II Treaty. And even as a early teenager, maybe not even teenager yet, I remember thinking, SALT II. If there's SALT II, what does that mean? Exactly. SALT I didn't work. And so why bother, with more peace treaties when we're not living by the ones that we already have? And one of the other things that I remember about that that whole conversation is remembering hearing a person say, "We can't sign a treaty with the Soviet Union, who is a godless nation, because they won't honor it. Because the moment that they need to do something different, they don't think there's a higher power to answer to, and so they'll go do what they want, which is why." Therefore, we needed SALT II to begin with. And so we've talked about peace and peace treaties, and we've tried everything. If you look and think about it, we've said we're going to build bigger guns and bigger missiles and bigger bombs so we can have peace. And we've signed treaties saying no, we're going to get rid of our guns and bombs so we can have peace. And we've said we're going to put missiles in the country next to you. No, we're going to take them out. And we've tried all kinds of things over the years, searching and looking for peace in a world level. But the fact of the matter is, it's not only on a world level, but for many of us individually, it's a lot the same way. We wrestle and struggle. It seems like, I don't know that I've ever done it before, but Lane was sitting there beside of me holding his song, and I poked him, and I don't know why, I just wanted to see what he was singing. And I got to reading it, just to tell you this, Lane wasn't even supposed to be singing today, and he told me, he said he didn't even know he had that song. He found it in his junk, he wasn't supposed to be singing, and he found a song he didn't know he had, and it fits perfectly. A lot of us often we just feel lost. It feels like we don't know which way we're going, which way is up. It seems like no matter what we do, we plan, we think, we lay things out, and it still seems like they fall apart, it seems like there's constantly we're battling and trying to find our way. And I think that's what Isaiah begins to deal with here in this chapter. It's an interesting passage of Scripture, and it's going to take a little bit of work and a little bit of, I hate to ask you to do this on Sunday morning at church, but you're going to have to think. It takes a little bit of work because Isaiah is writing to the people of Israel. He's talking to them kind of a twofold thing here in this chapter. He's talking about peace, and the Israelites at this time desperately needed peace. And so he talks about current peace, but he's also in this passage making future prophecies about the eternal peace of the reign of Christ. And what he's talking about here to the Israelites, the reason that this works, and the reason that and what Isaiah is dealing with to begin with, I think is what we need. I don't know about you, but a peaceable place. I remember when we built our house, one of the things that I noticed is we were out looking around at different floor plans, and I'd never seen it before. Grew up in the house of a carpenter. I had never seen that. Don't know that I've ever been in a house this way, but what a lot of the floor plans would be would be in the master bedroom. There would also be almost like a little living room or den in the master bedroom with, you know, couch, recliner, whatever, so that the husband and wife would have a kind of a room of their own, and that they could go there and wouldn't have to mess with the kids or whatever. And I don't know how that works, but it was kind of to be their own little retreat, their own little place. And I just didn't see the real value in it, but I really don't now, because here's how I know it would work at my house. Y'all in here? You know, I know how that would work. You know, just unless it was bolted up like Fort Knox, it just wouldn't work. I was watching. I don't know if y'all ever watched the show Shark Tank. I like that show. The other night they were doing a thing called the hoodie pillow, what it was a pillow, and they sewed a hoodie to it. If you saw it, and the idea was that you could lay down on like your couch, your bed, or whatever, and you could lay on that pillow and kind of pull your hood up and have kind of your own private little place. I'm like, yeah, right. That's got to be the funniest thing I ever heard of, because I know how that would work. Danny, you asleep? Yeah. Yeah, I know how that would work. Yeah, one of two things would happen. They'd come along, grab the strings and choke me, or they'd come along and yank it off. Daddy, you know, he's touching me. She's looking at me. You know, one of those, you know, that kind of thing. Y'all know, right? You know. The best idea with the hoodie pillow is put it on your kid backwards, you know, and put them in it and send them off for a while. That's what I think that all of us are looking for kind of that place of peace. You know, some folks it's vacation, whatever, we look for a place where we can go for a place like that. And that's what I want to talk to you about for a moment this morning, out of what Isaiah says to the people of Israel. The important thing, to begin with is to, take and let's get a little bit of background, on this passage. Israel desperately needed to know the Prince of Peace. Now, when I'm talking about Israel, I'm talking about at that time the Jews were divided. The kingdom, the northern half was Israel, and the lower half was Judah. They couldn't get along with each other, and so they had divided up. Isaiah lived around 721 B.C., and the thing that's important about that date is that at that time, Assyria was the superpower in the land. What we would call a superpower today. I don't know that they used that phrase, but they were the big dog on the block. They pretty well did what they wanted to. And they were massing their armies. They were preparing and planning an attack on the northern kingdom of Israel. And so at that time, Isaiah comes along. In the first 10 chapters of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah basically writes to the Israelites, you better duck, because the Assyrians are coming. Isaiah was the predecessor, if you will, to Paul Revere. Isaiah comes writing into Israel and he's saying, the Assyrians are coming, the Assyrians are coming. And so he gives them this warning. And the interesting thing is everybody knew it. You know, it wasn't a great big secret. You know, kind of like, you know, some of the things that have happened in Iraq over the last few years, where we get on the news and tell them for months we're coming. That's about what happened. Everybody knew that the Assyrians were coming. I think about, some of you don't Iraq news that didn't, but I think about Looney Tunes, okay? Jason just woke up. I think about the Looney Tunes, and I remember there was one of them where there was the picture of the cartoon. The turkey was sitting in the house there, you know, and he's sitting there listening to Elmer Fudd outside sharpening the axe and singing a Thanksgiving song. Well, that's about where Israel were. That's where they were located. They were sitting there, and the Assyrians are sharpening their axe, singing a Thanksgiving song. And so as they sit there, and Isaiah warns them about that, and he tells them, listen, the Assyrians are coming. And then he begins here in this chapter, and he says something. It's the only place in the entire Old Testament this phrase is used, where the family, the lineage of David, is addressed by Jesse, David's father's name. And he says, there will come a root out of the stem, or what modern translations say, the stump of Jesse. And so, you know, and we look at that and we say, okay, we kind of know what, we've read that verse before, we know that it's a prophecy. Understand the people of Israel. When they heard that, this is what they heard. We fixing to be cut down to a stump, because we are the lineage of David. We're about to be cut off. the Assyrians are coming. And so as he hears that, he said, they say to him, Isaiah says, listen, it's about to get bad. You're about to be chopped off. You know, the Israelites, you remember the New Testament, they were always around, we're of our father Abraham. You know, they were real proud of their lineage. We're of our father Abraham, David, blah, blah, blah. And Isaiah comes along and says, you might be of your father Abraham, you might be of the family of David, but I want to tell you something. The Assyrians are sharpening their axe, singing a thanksgiving song, and we are about to be cut down to a stump. You know, not going to be any big bush, not going to be any great big tree. We're going to be cut off like a stump. And then he says this, but he says out of that stump, he said, a little stem's going to start to grow. I remember when Ron and I first got married, there was a stump in our yard that I'd go out there every so often, and I'd whack on that stump, I'd chop that thing back, and you know, it looked like it was dead, and I got you this time, boy. And it, you know, it might take a year or so, I'd go back out there, and lo and behold, out of that stump here, you know, another little limb, a little tree. Well, that's what Isaiah's saying. Isaiah says, listen, we're going to be cut off like a stump. And he says, you'll notice the word branch there is capitalized because he's referring to Christ. And what he says to them is very simple. He says, I'm offering you hope. I want you to know that judgment is coming, that things are not always going to be lovely, but there is a branch of peace in our future. Now that being said, not only does Israel need to know the Prince of Peace, with that history in the background, we need to know the Prince of Peace. I'm not telling you this morning that you're about to be cut down to a stump. You may be, I don't know. Some of you may be going by the nickname Stumpy already because life's been that bad lately. You know, things have been going bad. You can't get the checkbook to balance. You can't get things at work to go right. Every time you go to the doctor, they find something new. You know, I can't tell you, I try to go get my dental checkup. I can't tell you the last time they've said I had a cavity in my mouth, but it seems like every time I go, what their new game now is, we don't see any cavities, but you got a feeling that you had from years ago that's bad. We need to drill it out and replace it. Yeah. Seems like it's always something. Yeah, you go and, you know, it seems like everywhere we turn, there's something else going wrong. And we need to know the Prince of Peace. The problem is, we struggle sometimes, with this idea of peace. I read a story, great book. Don Richardson was a missionary for many years to Papua New Guinea. I just think I'd like to live in a place called Papua. You know, not New Guinea, but Papua. But Papua New Guinea. And he wrote a book, and the name of it is called The Peace Child. And in the book, he talks about ministering to these folks, and he said the whole time he was there, said there were two tribes that were just in what he describes as a blood feud. I don't mean standing at the, you know, over on the sidelines going, you know, your mama's ugly. I mean, blood feud. They would raid one another. They would kill each other. I mean, there was a vicious feud between them. And he was translating scripture for them into their language. And he said, I had the hardest time, trying to get them to understand the concept that Jesus Christ, the Father, sent His Son to give His life so that we might have peace. And he said, I just couldn't get it across. And he said, finally, the natives did it for me. He said, the natives finally realized that if they kept up doing what they were doing, if they continued to fight the way they were, that eventually they were going to kill each other off and there was going to be no more tribe. And so they began to figure out, the two tribes came together and after years of fighting and realized we got to do something. And they came to this conclusion. The two chiefs of the tribes came together. And when they came together, they brought their sons. Each one of them brought a son. And when they came together, as they came and they met, what they did was the chief of this tribe gave his son to this chief. And this chief gave his son to this chief. And each chief then, their families adopted in the son of the rival chief. Took them back home and began to raise them and treat them like they were home. These two children, these two sons, they gave them the name the Peace Child. It's awful hard to attack another village when your son lives there. It's awful hard to attack that village and to be angry with that village when your son is part of that village. And Henderson began, he used that to explain to him. He said, that's the perfect picture of God's love for us, that He was willing to give His son so that we could have peace. Listen, I want to tell you, I look around today and I see folks, we're trying to find peace in all kinds of places. We're looking for peace in liquor bottles and drug bottles. We're trying to find peace in making more money. We're trying to find peace in getting a better job. We try to find peace if I could just live over here, if I could just have this, if I could just go there, if I could just do this. And we think somehow or another that's going to bring peace. The only thing that brings peace is the Prince of Peace. The Son of God. Listen, the folks, the good news today is that Jesus Christ is the restorer of dreams. He is the Prince of Peace. Not only the Prince of Peace, but you see the place of peace. Look what He says to us. He says, when we look at this, the Israelites need to understand that was the only place. Israel, here's what's interesting. They stood on the brink of destruction. If you read history of Israel, if you read Josephus, if you read Isaiah, if you read other Old Testament prophets, you'll discover that the Israelites, I mean, it was one of those situations where they could practically look out their back door and see the cloud of dust rising as the Assyrian army headed towards them. I mean, they were this close to destruction, and remember this: when we have a really difficult time making that leap. See, we live in a time. I heard somebody say one time, if you want to spruce up your country, pick a war with the United States. Yeah, and if you think about it, that's kind of true. We go to war with somebody. When the war's over, we go back and fix up their nation. We build it back better than it ever was. Well, that wasn't the way war worked in Isaiah's day. The way war worked in their day was, if I raided Tommy's kingdom, I went into Tommy's kingdom. If he had it and I liked it, I took it. If I took his money, I'd take his jewelry, I'd take his, if he had it and I liked it, I took it. If he had some good, strong sons, I'd make them slaves, that's just the way it worked. If you liked his wives, daughters, you took them home. That was just the way. And anything he had you didn't like, you burned it down. So either way, Tommy lost everything, and probably before it was all done, you killed Tommy. I mean, that was the way they played. They didn't play none of this, tag you're it stuff. I mean, when they had a war, they had a war. I mean, you either got carried away or destroyed. That was pretty much it. And so Israel's sitting here knowing that the Syrians are coming, and there's really nothing we can do about it. Isaiah's telling them it's because of your sin, because of your wickedness. And if you read the story, you begin to read, and you see the people of Israel going, why don't we have any peace? Why are things so bad? And Isaiah and the other prophets are saying, because you're evil. Because you're the devil. Because you're worshiping idols. Because you're mean and wicked. And the people of Israel kept going, we don't understand. And the prophets kept going, because you're mean. We don't understand. Because you're an idolater. We don't understand. Some of y'all been there with your kids, right? And that's the way they were. They just kept on and on saying, we don't get it. And Isaiah saying to them, listen, the only place you're going to find peace is in Jesus Christ, is in God. If that wasn't Jesus. But the promise of Christ. And he begins to tell them, said, that's the only place. Well, isn't that exactly the message that not only Israel needed, but we need today? We've decided that, peace comes from the next government handout. We've decided that peace comes from, the things of this world. When what Isaiah makes very clear, and if you read verses 2 through 5, he goes on and he lists the characteristics, and he says, the only way, the only place to find true peace is in God. See, here's what I've noticed. A lot of folks say, well, I'm going to go on vacation. I just need a break. Here's what I've noticed. Wherever you go, there you are. I've seen it. Wherever you go, there you are. You take your cell phone, you take your laptops, all these things. They call you. You get back and it's still there. A lot of folks think, oh, I can drink my problems away. You sober up and it's still there. A lot of folks think I can get a better job. I can make more money. It'll go away. You just get bigger bills. None of those things bring lasting peace. The only place you find lasting peace. Our world is begging for peace. And we look around, there's injustice, there's unfaithfulness. We got, you've probably seen some of these stories. I see stories about kids divorcing their parents. I wish they would. You know, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. That would be one of the first uncontested divorces ever. Listen, Tenzi told Caleb yesterday, get out. You know, kind of in that voice. You know, get out. You know, she's got a plan. You know, she wants Malia and Caleb to get out. You know, it's scary a little bit. You know, I keep thinking about throwing some holy water on her. Get out. You know. She's got a plan. You know, she'll have three rooms then. You know, and furthermore, Caleb's got a television in his room. And, you know, that actually belongs to him. You know, the cable it's hooked to is mine, but the cable is his. I mean, the TV is his. He actually bought the television, or is buying the television. I don't know. But not according to Tenzi. He's got to leave the TV. You know, it's one of those things, kind of, if you hook it to the wall, it stays. You know, Tenzi's like, get out. You know, she's got a plan for every room. They're all three going to be hers. You know, all going to be hers. She's got it all figured out. Matter of fact, she kind of already acts like Caleb's room's hers. You know. Yeah, well, you know, but it's all, you know, you've got kids, they're fighting. You know, parents are fighting, fighting at work, fighting in the neighborhood. Yeah, I'll never forget, I had to go to court one time, traffic related, by the way. Traffic related. And there were two women in there arguing about the location of their mailbox. You know. Take mine down. That way they can't drop off no more bills. What's the argument? Done. You know, I don't get it. But it's amazing the arguing. We live in a world that everybody, and if we admit it, people have aggravated us. And we, you know, they've robbed us of peace. And if we were to be honest this morning, we could say, you know what? I've done my fair share of peace robbing myself. You know, I've done my fair share. Listen, you know, peace is something that isn't coming until we repent. Listen to what he says, the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. He's talking about Jesus Christ. And he says, the Spirit of wisdom, I'm saying the Spirit of counsel, peace, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. If you keep reading, he's simply saying that the only place to find peace is in Jesus Christ. And the thing that all of us are searching for is the provision of peace. Israel needed to experience it. You know, it's difficult for me to really put it into real thought, what it would be like to have been Israel. I remember as a kid hearing all about Soviet Union and missiles and this kind of thing. And I remember even as a child thinking, you know, that I wonder if this area, Kannapolis, whatever, Concord, might be a target because of the meals and, be a target. You know, that's just the way a kid's mind thinks, you know. And, you know, as an adult, I look back and think, you know, a kid ought not have to be worrying if the Soviet Union's going to drop missiles on their neighborhood. You know, some of you grew up during you came along and you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, kids shouldn't have to worry about that. You know, kids shouldn't have to go to school wonder if some crazy man's going to come in, with a machine gun. You know, we shouldn't have to, you know, worry about some of those things, that our peace has been stolen. And Isaiah says, you know what? We need to enjoy the provision of peace. I cannot imagine what it would have been like for Israel to hear the prophet say, the Assyrians are coming. And they didn't just say the Assyrians are coming, but they say the Assyrians are coming and they're going to destroy you. What amazes me is why they didn't move. But imagine that. And Isaiah begins to promise them. He says, here's what the peace of the Messiah does. If you look, and I don't have time, verses 6 through 8, he talks about the provision of peace in nature. That great picture that I had up there a moment ago where the lion lays down with the lamb. The provision of peace over earth and nature. And ultimately the peace over the nations. You know, we look around and, you know, we look at that picture and, you know, the interesting thing about it is that he describes, and what Isaiah describes is peace between the lamb and the lion, where there's ordinarily not peace. You know, we have come to the point in our society where we just expect fighting in certain areas. It just doesn't even surprise us. When we turn on the news and we hear that there's been a racial battle, we're not even surprised anymore. When we turn on the news and we see some Arab throwing a rock at an Israeli soldier, we're not even surprised anymore. When we turn on the news and we hear stories of terrorism, we don't even flinch anymore. It's just become something we have become. We may not like it, but it's just become something that doesn't. Honestly, if we go a day where we don't hear those stories, we're surprised. We've come to that place. Listen, not only did Israel need to know the provision of peace, we live in a day and age where as much or more than ever, we need the provision of peace. Isaiah portrays a beautiful picture here of peace. I'll close real quick with a story. It'll take me just a minute. Stick with me. Kind of a lengthy story, but I'm going to abbreviate it. Back in the early 1990s, a man by the name of Stephen Cook, and I don't expect you to know the name or possibly even remember the story, but Joseph Bernardin, a Catholic cardinal, the Archbishop of Chicago, writes a book about this called The Gift of Peace. And what happened, and without all the details and everything that went on, is that Stephen Cook accused Cardinal Bernardin of abuse. And he was a young man at the time, and you know, pretty much everything about it doesn't need to be rehashed, other than the way the whole story wraps up and finishes up. Again, it was 1993 when the accusations became public. As you can imagine, the cardinal, front page of the paper, television, he is just trashed. Everybody, assumes guilt. His ministry's in question. His credibility, everything, because they immediately assume his guilt. But over a few weeks, over a little bit of time after that, Mr. Cook eventually comes forward and bit by bit acknowledges that everything he'd said, he'd made up. That not one shred of what he had accused the cardinal of was true. Well, when everything was cleared up and everything was dropped, the cardinal went back to work, plunged himself back into doing everything that was in his schedule as the archbishop. But he couldn't stop thinking about Mr. Cook. And he couldn't get him off his mind. Mr. Cook was now an adult. He was living alone, and he was dying with AIDS. And the cardinal just absolutely said that he could not get him off his mind. So he did something that I'm not sure many of us could do. He tracked down, he located where he was and how to contact Mr. Cook, and he invited him to Philadelphia, where they sat down for a meeting, to sit down to discuss everything that went on. And the cardinal explained, listen, the only reason I want to see you is I want you to know that I don't have any ill feelings towards you. Took a little bit of encouragement. Told him all I want to do is pray with you. But finally, Mr. Cook agreed to meet with the cardinal. He came in and he said, I want to apologize to you for all the hurt, the embarrassment, and the problems that I caused. And when all this happened, Stephen Cook, he told his story about how he had been alienated from the church and everything. And the cardinal came and he gave him an inscribed Bible, offered to celebrate Mass with Mr. Cook. Mr. Cook kind of hesitated at first. The cardinal pulled out a 100-year-old chalice and said, this is a gift from a man you don't know, but he asked me to use it to say Mass with you at some point. And Mr. Cook began to cry. They celebrated Mass. And after it was all over, when he was asked about everything that happened, Stephen Cook said, a big burden has been lifted from me today. It's a huge burden has been lifted. He said, I feel healed and very much at peace. Now, there are a lot of details of that story. There are a lot of things, that you and I, from the Mass to the Archbishop, a lot of things about that story that you and I may go, I don't know. And that's by far, that's not even the Reader's Digest version. There's a pile of that story that as you can imagine, I just skipped over because it's not really relevant. But here's what I want you to hear this morning. One of the best places to begin finding peace in your life is to let go of some of those things. To forgive. To practice forgiveness. Huge burden can be lifted off your shoulder today simply by forgiving. I can't tell you how many times in my ministry I've talked to people who were carrying grudges and burdens and things from you. Sometimes, as I've told you before, sometimes it's even against dead people. I mean, they're still harboring grudges now against people that have passed away, and they're still carrying it. Listen, if you want to experience that kind of world, where the lamb lays down with the lion. Some of you, to forgive would be about like the lamb laying down with the lion. You know what? Some of you, if you finally turn loose of that grudge, that hatred, that anger, it'd be about like the lamb laying. It'd be about like that little baby. I don't know if you can see or not. It'd be about like that little fella right there with his arm around a tiger's neck. That's about what, for some of you to go to that person and forgive or ask forgiveness, it'd be about the same as that baby riding that tiger. But I want to tell you something. I believe with all my heart you'll never experience everything that the Prince of Peace wants you to have as long as you carry it. Some of you this morning are dealing with other issues in your life. You're struggling, you're battling work, home. And the only place you'll find peace is through Jesus Christ. Some of you here this morning, you've never asked Christ into your heart. You've been struggling, you've been battling, you've been wrestling. You've been trying to find an answer. You've been trying to find some comfort. You toss and turn. You come to church and you get heartburn. And it's just simply this. You need peace with Jesus Christ. You're here today and you've never asked Him into your heart. You've never accepted Him as your Savior. Today is the day of salvation. You need to come this morning. Let us show you from God's Word how you can know Him as your personal Savior. Don't put it off another day. Don't wait another moment. As we stand, every head bowed for just a moment. As our musicians come, what's that thing you're battling? What's that thing you need rest from? That thing you need, in some people's eyes it may be small, but to you it's a mountain. You need to come this morning and kneel and say, Lord, I need peace. I need comfort. I need rest. As we sing together.